Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
CinemaSins has a fan club. It's called the Sin Club, and members get all sorts of things like early episodes, bonus videos, merch discounts, and even monthly bonus podcasts. Membership starts at $3 a month, and you can sign up now at patreon.com/CinemaSins.
The sound man would come up to me like during the day when we're between takes or whatever, and he would ask me like, "You on Team Ross or you on Team Boat?"
Welcome to SinCast, presented by CinemaSins.
All right, everybody, welcome to the SinCast. This is Chris Atkinson from CinemaSins, joined by Jonathan Watkins.
Hello, hello.
And Barrett Scher.
Hi there.
And today we have a very special guest. It is writer-director Tiller Russell, who has done a movie called Silk Road. It says it's coming out on digital on-demand theaters in February 19th and on Blu-ray and DVD February 23rd. Tiller, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm a fan, so it's nice to be here with you guys.
Oh, nice. What? You're a fan of us. Good. Let's get that out of the way first.
Hang on. Something must be wrong.
I'm turning the tables right from the jump, guys.
Yes, you have. So Silk Road is, first off, there was an article in Rolling Stone called "Dead End on Silk Road, Internet Crime Kingpin Ross Ulbricht's Big Fall," is what this is based on. It's based on the Silk Road, you could buy drugs and things on the dark web. When were you first aware of this story, and when did you start writing a screenplay over it?
Well, as somebody who spends most of his both professional work time as well as free time combing through crime stories, both for business and pleasure, I guess, I was really geeked on this story from day one. I was off shooting a documentary when I remember opening a USA Today article, and it was the day after Ross had been busted in the sci-fi section of the Glen Park Library in San Francisco. And even with the very cursory information that was in the initial reporting on it, I instantaneously had this visceral reaction. There's a movie in there. It may be a doc, it may be a feature film, who knows what, but I was fascinated by the story and by the guy behind it.
And you have Ross Ulbricht is a guy who doesn't seem much like a hardened criminal, but he certainly played the part, did he not?
Well, this is one of the things that gripped me from the get-go about this. It is, in a weird way, it seemed kind of very relatable. Here was this, kid from Texas. I'm 10 years older than Ross. And there was this kid that grew up in Texas. I grew up in Texas. I grew up as a kid thinking, man, I love movies, but I don't know anybody in Hollywood. How am I ever going to, become a filmmaker? And there were these interesting kind of parallels to his story. And what was, I think, particularly fascinating for me is you get this guy who goes into it as kind of a bit of a naive dreamer, right? He wants to change the world. He wants to make his mark. And to me, it becomes a bit of a Frankenstein story almost, where he creates this entity, the Silk Road Marketplace, and it becomes a monster that gets out of his hands. And by the end of it, that's what's grabbing him by the throat. And I think that fundamental nature of the story is what I found so compelling. And the transformation from this guy who went from being a dreamer to a visionary to a gangster to a legend in less than 2 years.
I want to get into casting and everything, but You know, you've cast Nick Robinson, who a lot of people probably know from Love, Simon, in this. But what I thought was interesting was in the article, they show a picture of him and they mentioned that he looks like Robert Pattinson. And I would not trade Nick Robinson in this movie for Robert Pattinson, but I did wonder if you wanted to get Robert Pattinson for this movie.
You know, I actually had talked, sat down and talked with Robert Pattinson very early on and at length about it, because he was fascinated by the story as well. And what happened is the, you know, movies take oftentimes so long from the germination of the idea to actually being on set and shooting the film that in some way or another, I think he kind of aged out of the part and, you know, he got busy with what he was doing. I got busy with what I was doing. And to go to the casting for a minute is really interesting. I ended up meeting with, you know, most of the sort of hot up and coming young leading men in Hollywood, and, you know, a huge range of them, because it's, you know, it's an interesting part, I think. And when I sat down with Nick Robinson, I was instantly captivated, because there is this fundamental sweetness and vulnerability to him as a human being. And, you know, I knew that in the course of the film, you're going to take an audience on this dark journey. And if you're going to do that, where your protagonist or your antagonist, as the case may be, your anti-hero, you know, is going to go on this dark journey, you have to be able to emotionally connect with him on the front end to be able to take that ride. And I just found Nick so winning and likable that as soon as I sat with him, I was like, that's the guy.
Well, speaking of the guy, I mean, this character, I was struck by his sincerity about, quote, changing the world. It's weird. There's a certain kind of self-effacing thing that he has in the script where he's like, this is corny. He'll preface something by saying this is corny, but this is actually what I believe. You know, I want to change the world. I want to, you know, have the one thing, that kind of thing. How much is that from your personal experience with the actual person behind this, the actual Ross, and how much of this is something that that the actor himself brought to it?
It's a great question, and let me address it by opening it up even further, which is, as somebody that goes back and forth between nonfiction films and, you know, narrative films, this was a very interesting blend for me, because what I did was I approached this initially the same way that I would a documentary, where you are doing all of the research. There was this kind of amazing archive, vast and varied archive of material that painted these different and contrasting and often conflicting portraits of Ross. You have his public posts as Dread Pirate Roberts, you know, on the Silk Road website. You had his diaries, which were on his laptop, which was confiscated after his arrest. You had his chat logs, his interactions with you know, Nob, the character portrayed by Jason Clarke in the film, as well as many other people. So you had this, I had this access to his voice. And, you know, 99%, I would say, of the voiceover that's in the film is drawn from these sources with little to no change whatsoever to it, because I wanted to hew as closely to the authentic story and the spirit of him as a human being. And then the other thing was, Ross's ex-girlfriend, Julia V, who's portrayed by Alexandra Shipp in the film, was actually a consultant to me in making the movie. So in writing the script and in, you know, answering questions in pre-production and production. So while I didn't have access to Ross Ulbricht himself, because he was you know, awaiting appeals after
indisposed.
Although interestingly enough, there's nothing I would love more, you know, having spent now years fascinated by this guy and thinking about him when I go to sleep at night or when I wake up in the morning, I'd really genuinely love to sit down with him now, you know, eye to eye, man to man, and just have a real conversation, because I am so fascinated to know what it, you know, what his perspective is like from the inside. So the long-winded answer to your question, which is, because of all the sort of documentary materials that exist, we tried to hew as closely as possible to Ross's character. And he would use these turns of phrase like corny. And he was this true blue believer in the libertarian ethos. This wasn't like a sort of mask or a charade or a put on. This was what animated this guy in at the deepest levels, you know, according to those who knew and loved him in his own record. So I tried to be as spiritually true to the story as possible.
Yeah. And that's one of the things right at the beginning, it says, you know, this story is based on a true story or is true or whatever, except for the stuff that we made up.
Right.
And I do appreciate that, because I do feel like a lot of times movies sort of skate behind that whole based on a true story thing, and they just make up all sorts of stuff. But after reading the article that this is based on, you didn't do too much making up stuff in this. The only thing that I noticed from this is that I feel like Jason Clark's character Nod is basically the what you embellished the most in this.
Yeah, his character is a composite. There were a couple of crooked law enforcement officers, some for DEA, some for Treasury, that were involved in this case. And so what I did was I kind of pulled elements from the historical record, where you're taking different bits and pieces of these characters and what was available and out there, and then combining and compositing them into one character. And then, you know, some of the relationships that come off from it. So again, you know, as you see the chat logs in the film that are the interactions between Dread Pirate Roberts, who's Ross, and Nob, the character played by Jason Clark, all of those, everything that's in the written chat logs, all of that stuff is real. There really was a guy called Nob, and he was involved in doing this. But the elements of Jason Clark's character, that's the sort of fictitious part of it. But even that is drawn from the historical record, or even drawn from, there's an actor named Daryl Britt Gibson who plays Rayford, who's a, you know, informant of Jason Clark's character, Rick Bowden. Mm-hmm. And that stuff is drawn, you know, as somebody who spends a lot of time with narcs and crooks and informants and people from the underworld and from law enforcement, all of that stuff is drawn from people that I know and real relationships that exist. And I guess in some sense also bits of my own personal biography are poured into those characters. And so it felt important to acknowledge right from the get-go the fact that it's a fusion of fact and fiction.
I love the line with Jason Clark's character. I mean, this probably comes from you, and obviously Jason Clark gives a great performance, but I loved the... I love the line that you kind of play with there, where, you know, he is a dirty cop, right? But he does have a family. We see that side of him and everything. But at the same time, he does get called out on all of his BS, right? He gets, you know, he gets punished in some ways that, you know, I think some movies would make him the hero in the end. To give too much away.
No, it's interesting to me. What I guess I'm drawn to as a filmmaker and storyteller, and as a movie lover and movie core too, generally is stories that have conflicting cross currents to them, and kind of characters who are in turmoil and in conflict with themselves in some fundamental way. And for me, both of these characters, Jason Clark's character, mm-hmm. as well as, you know, the character played by Nick Robinson, Ross Ulbricht, these are men that are roiling with their own internal contradictions and conflicts. And to me, the fact that they're not necessarily easily likable, you know, sort of winning in every decision that they make. That's to me what makes them compelling characters.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, there's a moment, and again, I don't want to spoil anything in the movie, but there's a moment in here where, right after Ross believes that he has successfully put out a hit on somebody, he tells Jason Clark's character, you know, like, you sometimes you have to do a great wrong to make a better right, or an even mm-hmm. greater right, or something like that. And mm-hmm. I don't know, it's either been a while or I've never seen it where a character who is quote unquote the bad guy gives basically accidental advice to the good guy, who is not really the best of good guys, but still, it's a piece of philosophy that ends up, you know, affecting his character as well. I love that moment.
You know, it's funny for me from the get go. The whole notion of the movie was you have these two guys that have these opposing arcs, and I kind of thought about it like it's almost like they're missiles that are fired at each other from far away, and they're mm-hmm. heading right toward each other, you know, and they're exactly the wrong people. To be aimed at, and it ends up kind of vaporizing both of these guys' lives. And yet, in a weird way, though they, you know, with one exception, never see each other or in the same place, in the same room at the same time, it's all mitigated and mediated via the screen. In a weird way, there's this bond between them where it's sort of like it's the only other person that is walking in this lane or in this, you know, pathway of darkness, so that there is this kind of weird emotional bond and connection between them.
Yeah. I do want to talk about the casting process. We've talked a little bit about Nick Robinson. We've talked some about Jason Clark. How did you come up? How did you find the actors who would be in this movie, which, you know, has a pretty big sprawling narrative? So you've got a lot of people here to cover.
Well, it was, I felt very lucky and grateful to have found a, you know, an eclectic and colorful and talented cast. Everybody from, you know, Katie Hazelton to Paul Hauser to Daryl Brett Gibson to Alexandra Shipp. I felt like I kept getting lucky where it was one amazing performer after another who was going to come in and build out this world. And then you saw these people and it was almost as if everybody, when you have people like, you know, we started the film and we actually shot it almost as if it were two separate films. There was the Jason Clark movie and we mm-hmm. shot all of Jason Clark's side of the film. And then with, you know, a day or two of overlap, Nick and Jason, and then we shot the Nick Robinson movie. And so it was almost.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Right. Oh, cool. So literally though, that was kind of determinative of the experience of it. And it was funny, you know, people, the sound man would come up to me like during the day when we're between takes or whatever. And he would ask me like, you on Team Ross or are you on Team Boat? And I always would kind of laugh because it was like, okay, whoever we're shooting today, that's whose team I'm on, man.
That's so funny.
But yeah, you've got, what is it about Paul Walter Hauser, man? This guy seems like he comes out of nowhere. In I, Tonya was his big break and everything. And everything I've seen him in since, he's just engaging in a way that I don't know. What is it about him? What is his process? How do you get him?
He is just nothing short of spectacular. I mean, and that's, you know, that's why it's like Eastwood, you know, stars in the Eastwood movie. Spike Lee puts him on. Like, you just can't miss with this guy. He's so... Mm-hmm. He's so funny and smart and game. And, you know, with something like this, it was, you know, I felt so grateful to have him. And he came and, you know, working with Jason Clark, the role that he's in, you get Jason Clark just like manhandling him and just mauling him everywhere possible, you know. And I literally, there's the scene where like Jason Clark's, you know, drowning him in the like bathtub or whatever. And I literally, as soon as we started rolling on that one, I thought, Jesus Christ, Clark's going to kill him, you know. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, Paul pops up and he gets his head out of the water and he's like, oh, all right, let's go again. And I'm like,
crazy. I love that scene too, because I don't think I've ever seen an interrogation scene in a movie where the, or at least I don't remember one where the person being interrogated is more than willing to answer the questions, but he's not really being allowed to.
It was so funny. I was literally howling when we were shooting the film. At a certain point, somebody looked over at me and they're like, "Dude, why are you laughing? This is super disturbing and weird." You know?
No, it's a great dynamic. It's something that, like Jonathan said, you never see on there, especially when he gets back. And, you know, this is the mark of a great performance. When you have the water shot staring up at him, he's got all this expression of terror, but also like bemusement. Like, it's just, it's such an unusual scene, but it's just delightful. I loved it.
Yeah. Paul is such a gamer. He's such a wonderful performer. And it was so funny. You know, the specifics of his character, as we were talking about it, you know, prior to him coming to set, so much of this takes place online, right? So it's like people are sitting there behind their computers and the interaction is written rather than verbal, as is the nature of, you know, a lot of our communication these days. And Paul and I hit on the idea where it was like, what if this dude's a mumbler? Where he's like, you know, as he's talking, he's like saying this shit aloud, you know, to himself, and then talking to himself. And as soon as Paul had that, he just ran with it. And then, you know, you add a ferret, and how can you go wrong?
Yeah, so he's got an outlet. He's got someone to quote talk to.
He's got an partner, man. He's got a ferret.
That was you know, you were talking about this torture scene, that there were elements that felt like Zero Dark Thirty in this movie. I mean, especially with, you know, Jason Clarke's being in it, and then just the fact that they're looking for someone that is using some really difficult encryption methods, or they're just hard to find in general, and you have to find those really small things. He seems to be able to do it the old school way by just going in and pretending like he's somebody who uses the Silk Road and everything. But it looks like behind the scenes, the FBI is doing some pretty good work that we don't really get to see here. But was it really hard to find this guy, or was he so brash about what he was doing that it actually didn't take long to find it?
Well, it's a good and complicated question. I think in a weird way, what it was there's a simplicity to the genius of the idea, where you take Tor, which enables you to place these orders, you know, online in an anonymous fashion, and you use Bitcoin as the currency, right? Mm-hmm. So the combination of anonymity and cryptocurrency, like, that's the genius of the idea. And it's actually a very simple idea, blending these two things. But what it did was, and I think in a weird way, it's why Ross had the book thrown at him. The real Ross is a human being, and God, mm-hmm. to me, I think, is actually a terribly draconian sentence. You know, the real guy is serving double life plus 40 without the possibility of parole, which is significantly worse than what El Chapo's sentence was, for example.
Oh, wow.
So it's not to sort of excuse it or give any kind of like easy explanation to it. I mean, if you have a loved one who died from drugs purchased on Silk Road, I'm, you know, deeply kind of and painfully empathetic to that. So it's not this is not an easy kind of morality judgment one way or another. But, you know, it's complicated. I guess that's why to me it was rich and fertile material for a film. But as soon as Ross had the idea to do that, and then to outsource, instead of using a physical server, to outsourcing it to a server farm in Iceland, essentially, then you literally physically can't trace it. And so what this guy did overnight was he completely changed the war on drugs. Suddenly, like, the postman is a dope dealer inadvertently, mm-hmm. and, like, you know, yeah. doesn't know it, but like, that's who's bringing this to your house. And so it was such a sort of transformative moment, and law enforcement in general was caught so flat-footed that it required this massive mobilization to find him. And yet, on the other hand, there is this sort of like brashness and arrogance to Ross, where it's like, okay, I'm beating the system. You know, people haven't found me there. You know, they haven't found me yet. They're not gonna find me. And, you know, it, such that he ends up getting arrested at, you know, the public library in San Francisco.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, it's a weird combination. And that was what was, I think, sort of so true about this story. You know, so, or so fascinating rather about this story all the way through is, all of it is very complex in terms of the morality and sort of what was happening in the characters that were defined by it.
Yeah, we see that in the movie that Ross seems a little disturbed that his creation is, you know, bringing, you know, there's the story of the 16-year-old kid who died taking drugs bought off of Silk Road. And it looks like it does affect him a lot. You mentioned his sentencing and everything. I think if you ask most lawyers about this question there, it's not so much that this guy doesn't deserve to get punished, but there's just not a consistency with sentencing with a lot of similar crimes and everything. And you're saying he's got a worse sentence than El Chapo.
Yeah. And you know, what's I think tragic about that in human terms is, for good or ill, this was kind of a work of genius that this kid created. And, you know, it ended up being the gift of the, or the, you know, the product of the first half of his life. But I don't know, I guess as a human being, I'm just a believer in second chances. You know, I've failed and made mistakes, you know, countless times. And just the notion that, you know, this kid is going to, you know, condemned to die in prison and never have a second shot is tragic to me.
I like that coda in the movie of the VO of him saying that, I guess at his sentencing hearing, where he puts that in very articulate context of like, look, I'm acknowledging what happened here, but also, you know, let me live out the rest of my days and try to, you know, do some good and that kind of thing. And I think that is a nice contextual coda to that, rather than just demonizing this whole process, because yeah, he does break bad in a sense, right? He becomes the Walter White character, especially with the decisions that he makes, with you know, personal decisions, but also you could tell how that weighs on him. You could tell that he's not a quote bad guy, right? It's the Jason Clarke monologue at the end of like shades of gray but black and white. He's right in that gray. And I appreciate that as a character, and I'm glad you fleshed that out within the context of the movie.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up that specific point about the voice, you know, the final voiceover. It was a fascinating process. My editor Greg O'Brien and I went through all of Ross's you know, the chat logs and the diaries and you know, his commentary at sentencing. You know, all of his words basically that existed. And we really wrestled with what to leave the viewer with. We had a version of it, again, all taken from his words, that was the kind of brash, defiant, you know, unbowed, kind of punk rock, on the system, you know, ethos thing. And it felt like, you know what, the final words that this guy kind of made in public were those pleading for, I guess a second chance, you know? And so, that was heartbreaking and an interesting kind of unexpected way to go. So we finally ended up choosing the latter rather than the former after, you know, recording it both ways, screening it both ways for different audiences. And finally that was the decision we made.
God, it's hard to make a movie, Tiller, right? Like you have to go through all this bullshit. My God, how does a movie ever get fucking made? You got to go through test audiences and then you got to do editing two versions. You got to shoot two. It's crazy that you made this movie. I'm proud of you.
It's so funny that you say that. It really is true. Every time I, and as a movie goer and, you know, audience member, I'm sort of so rarely critical of things because I know this was an all out war for anyone to ever get one frame of anything, much less like finish it and get it out into the world. And it really is, it literally is a miracle every time a movie hits the screen, because, you know, so many things have to line up and you have to get so lucky to do it. So I'm super grateful and privileged to have the chance and psyched to be bringing it into the world.
A couple of other actors in this that I'm interested in. Obviously, Jimmy Simpson has sort of become a legendary character actor at this point. And Daryl Brick Gibson, who I think anybody who's watched Barry, he's great. And Alexander Shipp. Can you elaborate on their casting and where you got them?
Yeah, absolutely. All of every single one of those actors was just such a gift. Jimmy Simpson, it's so funny. Literally, as soon as the first like frame of dailies came in, my editor called me and he's like, "Put this guy in every movie you do for the rest of your life, no matter." Jimmy was such a pleasure to work with because he's so he's like such a finely tuned instrument, and he would say, "Okay, give me the most like micro adjustments possible. Like, I love, like, you want a line reading? Give me a line reading. Great, I love a line reading." And it was kind of like he was so malleable and willing to be direct and so kind of like brave and open with it. It was such a pleasure to work with him. He also has a brother who I forget exactly who he works for. It's, you know, the NSA or somebody along those lines, some sort of, access to sort of sensitive security information. And as soon as he said that, I was like, "Dude, get your brother on the phone," because like he just became an accidental tech consultant for us. Nice. Jimmy was so like wonderful and gracious with like, you know, bringing his brother into the equation. And because I'm a big believer in, and I have kind of an army of tech consultants generally the way I work, because as a documentary guy, you want the authenticity and specificity of it. So every single thing like that was a gift. And Daryl Britt Gibson, again, just amazing, amazing performer. I can't wait to do more work with him. It was so amazing. Once he got on set and I saw him in there with Jason and like the first scene they did together, I was like, "Dude, these guys are doing 48 hours. This is like unbelievable." Off with these two guys, you know? And I walk up to Daryl, you know, after the first take or two, and I'm like, "How you doing, man?" He's like, "Man, I'm hitting my threes, and I'm going to be hitting them the whole time I'm here." And I just, and then Alexander Shipp, it was so amazing too, because when you're dealing with, you have this very, with a film like this, you have a very limited amount of prep time. And, everybody's got complicated schedules that you're trying to jigsaw, getting them in and out, you know, between other movies that they're doing or TV shows or whatever. And so there's a very finite amount of time to have the deep relationship building that you need to have kind of credible, lived-in, believable performances. And obviously with Nick and Alexandra, they had this sort of long, rich history, you know, Love, Simon. Mm-hmm. And so I knew that by putting them together, they would be able to draw on the intimacy that they already had and bring the relationship between the two characters together. And I also thought, you know, hopefully it's fun for audiences too, that were, you know, people that were fans of Love, Simon, to like see the repairing of these two, you know, all grows up.
Yeah, she's great. Tragedy Girls, I think, was one of the first times I saw her, and just like, she's amazing.
And so fun to work with. You know, she was very just kind of like a ray of light on the set, where, you know, playful and funny and, you know, teasing the director of photography, and just a real pleasure to work with.
Yeah. And Jimmy Simpson's got one of my favorite scenes, a smaller scene where it's just when Jason Clark brings that folder in or that file in, And Jimmy Simpson's just like, yeah, just put that somewhere. I won't look for it later.
Right. Yeah, that's actually Will Ropp, who plays Jason's boss, this like younger millennial boss in that particular scene, who's an amazing young performer too.
Yeah.
He's actually in the opposite Ben Affleck in his recent film, and is like such a funny, talented guy. And I love that mustache that we ended up with on him. You know,
that's fabulous.
Oh yeah, he's great.
He was an unexpected pleasure and treat, just kind of hilarious. Like, and anytime you can get Jason Clarke stirred up and crazy and infuriated, you know it's
Jonathan. Are you talking about the scene after that scene though?
Yeah, I am. It's the where he walks in with the FBI.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. I know.
No worries.
You know my movie better than me. You're
probably seen all it more recently.
There's two file scenes.
There are two file scenes. That's exactly right.
Well, everybody so far has been a pleasure to work with. Who are the dicks on this set? Yeah. I mean, I really want.
No, here's the sort of the dickish enterprise in it was really was me managing kind of I had this like insane year where I had multiple projects that were going simultaneously. I was doing a series for Amazon called The Last Narc. I was doing The Night Stalker for Netflix. And doing this film simultaneously, you know, you sit around your entire life and you're like, they'll never all get greenlit at the same time. And then all of a sudden they did. And I was just in like an absolute dead panic over like what to do and how to survive it, and whether I could manage it. And it was, but I also felt like, gosh, this is a once in a lifetime opportunity to have, you know, these amazing projects and kind of canvases to work on. So, you know, I called my brother and I said, what do you think? And he's like, dude, saddle up and suck it up. You're getting out of the cannon. And so that's what I did.
You had mentioned up at the top that this movie feels like, you know, just sort of an extension of other movies that you have done recently. Now, I hate to admit that I have not seen a couple of these movies, but it does feel like the 7-5 and Operation Odessa sort of fit into this real world, real crime narrative and everything. And I was wondering if that's what you're referring to when you're saying that this is sort of the sort of an extension of those.
Yeah, how one spills into another. I think very much it is. You know, it like my entire professional life and I guess career has kind of been looking at the thin and sometimes porous boundary between cops and crooks. And in the 7-5, it's, you know, this crew of corrupt cops marauding their way through New York in the 90s. In Operation Odessa, it's the story of these three crazy gangsters, a Russian mobster, a Miami playboy, and a Cuban narco who sell a submarine to the Cali cartel for $20 million. And then, you know, on the cop side of things, there's The Last Narc and Night Stalker. And in a weird way, all of it is, I think that they're kind of portraits and pieces of the underworld and explorations of, I guess, just the underbelly of America in a fundamental way. And so this felt like a really natural addition to that. And I don't know why exactly. You know, my wife teases me about, you know, she's like, you know, your compass, most people's compass is pointed to true north. Yours is pointed to true crime. But it's true. You know, I do find it, riveting, I guess, because I think it's kind of as close as we get to war, maybe, in a civilian society. And so when you're people who are, and this is true whether you're a gangster or whether you're, a cop or undercover cop or whatever, every time those people walk out the door, the stakes are potentially life and death. And so the quotient for drama is just so high.
You do a great job with the true crime stuff, by the way. I watch Night Stalker, and I've read about him in the past, and I've seen other documentaries on him, and I had never seen a lot of the stuff that you you had in that narrative. And you did a great job of just not, I guess, glorifying him at all, which is, you know, a problem that some true crime docs have with these kind of things. It felt very personal, and it was just, and also just terrifying. What was that like making that?
Well, it was fascinating, and it was kind of harrowing and horrifying at the same time. You know, on the one hand, I had access to these, you know, this astonishing array of materials. So it was hundreds, if not thousands, of crime scene photos, and you know, some people have sort of noted the. I guess the sort of brutal nature of some of the imagery that's in there, but by comparison to what we had at our disposal, that's a very carefully selected, curated set of images that are in there. And so it's like literally just being exposed to that level of kind of the reality of the horror and kind of gruesomeness was an intense experience. And it becomes this, you know, with all of these projects, with both of these projects, it's a very fine line because, you know, you are telling these stories which need to be gripping and sort of consumable and fascinating. And yet at the same time, you never want to cross the line into being exploitative or cheap or tawdry in any way. So you're constantly kind of like having to recalibrate. Okay, this is fascinating, but is this off-putting or is this... you know, are we crossing a line here? And so with the Ramirez story, it was, you know, and that story is so strange because this guy has had this, you know, once apprehended, has had this like surreal afterlife getting kind of turned into this, you know, sex symbol and object of desire. Yeah. And so it was super important to me not to glamorize or lionize him in any way, and to make audiences, like, part of the reason why I selected those, you know, the sort of the horror and specificity of those crime scene photos is to make you realize, hey, this is real. This is not, you know, and to sort of make us confront our own, you know, what is it about all of us that are sort of so fascinated by these kinds of stories and that level of depravity? You know, we're all complicit in it to some extent. By engaging in it. And so it's, you know, hopefully giving you a bit of pause and making you like, man, why am I so fascinated with it?
What's your background, Taylor?
I was a, you know, I grew up in Dallas, Texas, and my dad was in the district attorney's office. It was depicted in Errol Morris' film, The Thin Blue Line.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so as a kid, he would take me around to like the courthouses and jails and precincts or whatever. And, I think the notion was that I would be scared straight, but instead I was like, dude, these are my people. You know? And so, you know, from there I ended up, you know, becoming a crime reporter because because I could hang around, you know, in those places with those people and speak the language. And then weirdly enough, it was actually Errol Morris years later, once I was a reporter, who I did a profile of, and I had this incredible evening with him, and you know, while he was promoting some film, and you know, got saddled with me at the end of the day for his interviews. And he's like, "Dude, I'm so sick of these interviews. You want to get a steak and a bottle of wine?"
Nice.
I thought, nothing more on earth that I want to do than like get a steak and a bottle of wine with Morris, you know. And we had this kind of fascinating evening together. And at the end of it, he turned over and he put his hand on my shoulder and he said, "You're either going to spend the rest of your life writing about people like me, or you're going to try your hand at this." And I literally quit my job at the newspaper the next morning. And I
was, holy shit. That's a crazy story.
It's true. And I'm looking forward to reconnecting with him, because for him, it was probably a throwaway evening that he, you know, doesn't even remember. Changed the course of my entire adult life. You know?
Wow. Wow. That's amazing. And yeah, so now you're actually for getting access to all these crime scene photos and the information. And you mentioned that you were familiar with narcs and CIs and stuff like that. Like, how far are you embedded into this? Is it as a documentarian or a filmmaker, or is it more that you had that life when you were a reporter?
Well, it's all, again, it's sort of like it's one thing has bled into another. And so, you know, it was really interesting, actually, with regards to the, you know, the NARC and sort of CI thing. I was shooting this Amazon series, The Last NARC, which you know tells the story of the murder of this DEA agent in Mexico in 1985 by these cartel guys. But the guy that ran this investigation, Hector Boreas, is this fascinating, you know, larger than life kind of gunslinger narc. And I was shooting these two things, and I was like, dude, Jason Clark has got to meet this guy, and this guy has got to meet Jason Clark. So I like sent them off together out in Riverside to like go get a taco. And you know, smart actors being what they are, Jason Clark clocked the fact that Hector, who's the former, you know, retired DEA agent, had this like amazing kind of, you know, Mexican style belt buckle with a rooster on the front of it. And when he came to set, he was wearing that belt buckle. And I was like, nice. I love this guy. You know?
Anything else, guys? I know Barrett, you wanted to talk about Bernie a little bit.
Well, okay. So you mentioned the, you know, growing up in Dallas, I notice, you know, obviously with Night Stalker and where Silk Road started, and of course, with your affiliation with Bernie and Richard Linklater's direction in that movie, you seem like a Texas dude, man.
Oh,
like,
I'm a Texas dude.
You guys are all like a kind of a community there, right?
It's so funny, you know, like wherever you go, if you're a Texan, it's like somehow you magnetize to other Texans, whether you like it or not. It's like, you know, magnets, they pull each other together. But you know, I don't know. I think there is something interesting about Texas where it's one of those weird kind of outlier places in America that has a strong local cultural identity. So, you know, you get these crazy ass characters and wild ass stories that come out of Texas. And so, you know, and all of us, I think in some fundamental way, you live in our childhoods, wherever it is, you know, whatever the sort of formative stuff is.
Sure.
You never get that far from it, you know?
So just briefly, because everybody should watch Silk Road because that movie rocks, but also tell these two, Jonathan and Chris, why they should watch Bernie, because that movie rules.
It's absolutely amazing. And I had a very minor part in that, but it's all 100% Linklater, but it's such a, like that story is just, it's batshit crazy. If you
it
were
sure is.
That story and sort of like, if you were in a writer's room and you pitched that story, you would immediately be fired for being like an incompetent moron. But because it's true, it's so bonkers and the performances are just so captivating. And I just think Linklater's a genius. I'm such a fan, you know, from that first film on, anything he ever does, man, I'll buy the ticket and take the ride. He's just brilliant.
He's definitely one of the best for sure.
And just year after year, film after film, just keeps doing it, man. His own voice and his own vision and, you know, such an inspiration.
No kidding. I have to ask one more question practically about the Silk Road. Because it takes place in all these different environments. How much was shot on location? How much was set? And what do you prefer? Like, you know, that kind of thing. Like, practically, how did this all work out?
Yeah, great question. What ends up happening is, and this is kind of like the default model for most movies nowadays, is you end up shooting the bulk of principal photography oftentimes in places where there are tax incentives so that you're able sure. to get, you know, rebates on that money and your dollar goes further, right? You're able to get more mm-hmm. days or, you know, whatever it is that you choose is almost always shoot days with directors. They're like obsessive because that's all you get is just sort of time. Right. And then time.
Yeah.
So, and there's never enough of it, no matter what you do. So the bulk of it was shot in New Mexico. And then there was kind of a movable feast of splinter units in Austin, in Baltimore, in San Francisco, so that you're able to, and I think it was sort of The Big Short. I think that Adam McKay kind of pioneered this initially. Or sort of mastered it at, you know, what all of us, you know now and kind of reference is, then you're able to give something the scope and geographical diversity, and yet you're still able to anchor the production by shooting it primarily in one locale. So it's as efficient as possible.
Oh, that's fascinating. That's fascinating. So you almost, I don't want to call it a trick, but you almost trick the viewer's mind into saying, oh, this is totally Baltimore, even if it's on set in New Mexico or something like that.
Exactly. Because if you think about it, the interior of a house or an office building or you know, anything that's an interior, by and large, they're not kind of geographically specific. So whether you're shooting in Canada or Dallas or Austin or San Francisco, interiors are kind of interiors. And then, you know, once all of a sudden you step outside into the street, that's all you need is a couple of shots to really sell it. And it creates this, you know, enveloping illusion that the entire thing was shot there by, you know, careful, you know, shot selection and editorial construction. You're able to sell the movie magic, I guess.
I've been asking this question a lot recently, but what was your toughest day filming this movie?
Probably the toughest day was I was with Jason Clark and Katie Azleton in the aquarium when they are taking their daughter to the aquarium, kind of having this, you know, marital fight over his, you know, the fact that they've got a kid that's got a learning disability and, you know, the kind of personal dramas of a marriage. And what ended up happening is the kid who, Lexi Raves, who's a terrific actor, actually in the Avengers movie and, you know, among other things, that day she was totally sick and so couldn't be in the scene. And so we're sitting there and it's like, okay, my God, what are we going to do? We have to get the scene. And so we had the stand-in actor at the time who was, you know, just there as a double. And I was like, okay, Jason, Katie, get over here. We're rewriting the scene. All the lines that the kids were going to say, we're going to figure this out. So we literally rewrote the scene together very quickly and we used the stand-in actor instead of the actual actor because she was sick that day. And so we had to like figure out how to reconstruct it all, you know, under a very tight time frame. And everybody was so game to do it. It ended up miraculously working. So.
Wow. Had to use some silhouette, I guess, right?
Yeah, exactly. And then carefully stage it in such a way that, and it was so funny when we finished the movie, I told the story to the editor and he's like, bullshit. And I'm like, are you kidding me? And I
was like, isn't that interesting? Like, that's not a place where I would typically be looking for, you know, that kind of, you know, a change in actor, a stunt double or anything like that. So you've already put it in the viewer's mind that there's this, you know, there's his daughter is in the scene somehow. And then, you know, and then you just sort of just like, you know, just do this expert type of like, let's just throw that under the rug. This is not about her. This is, you know, I mean, it's about her, but it's not, you know,
that's what filmmaking is. It's basically like one catastrophe after another befalling you through the entire thing and then having to like improvise your way out of it and hopefully, you know, make it credible to the audience by the end. But that really is the truth of the matter.
By the way, all the scenes with Jason Clark and Katie Azles, that whole storyline was fascinating. I like how they were really good together, and that final scene with them got me a little teary-eyed. So
she's a beautiful, powerful actor, and the two of them together, and that final scene, you know, really got me too. Shooting it,
and it's really funny. Only really knowing her, well, I think I've seen her in a few other things, but the main thing I know her from is The League.
Right.
It's really interesting seeing her.
Yeah, she's
very different.
She's a real talent. She's a real talent.
Yeah, she is.
Anything else, guys?
I just want to mention the Tillers. You are so smart. You're very smart. And this has been a pleasure. And can we talk to you like when your next film comes out?
Absolutely. I will be back. Like I said, I'm a fan. So it's an honor to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you guys so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, my goodness. This is a lot of fun.
Awesome.
All right. We would like to thank Tiller for his time. The movie is Silk Road. It comes out on digital on demand and in theaters February 19th and Blu-ray and DVD on February 23rd. And so yeah, go see that movie. Go see it. It's good. It's really good. But that's going to do it for this interview. It's Chris Atkinson, Jonathan Watkins, and Barrett Scherer. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. Comment on our episodes on our SoundCloud page. Check us out on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Reddit. And be sure to visit cinemasins.com.